Hey everybody, it's JT. What is on your holiday meal shopping list? Well, I would suggest Painted Hills Natural Beef. It is some of the best beef in the world. And your friends and family will be thanking you for a long time if you serve Painted Hills Natural Beef for your holiday meals. And now you can buy it online just by going to PaintedHillsBeef.com. Use the code BBQNATION at checkout and save yourself 15% on your order. Give Painted Hills Natural Beef a place on your table this holiday season.
It's Barbecue Nation with JT on a Northwest Lifestyle Weekend. Now here's JT.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Nation. That would be the Barbecue Nation. I'm JT here at the grill, and Doc Bourne, he's here. He's upright.
Hey!
And he's actually breathing correctly. Hey, one of the biggest decisions that folks grilling, smoking, or barbecuing is what type of seasoning and rub, and in some cases sauces, to use. I know you have that problem, David.
I do.
Sauce.
I just pour it on.
We've talked about that a bunch here on the Nation, of course. But today we welcome back our friend, Stephen Reichland, to get to the meat of the subject, you might say. Stephen's new book on barbecue sauces, rubs, and marinades is out, and it is quite definitive on these subjects. So, and one little quick thing here, Stephen's kind of a Florida guy, so we have a little Florida music with Jimmy Buffet there.
Nice.
for Stephen today. Anyway, welcome back to the show, Stephen.
Hey, great to be here, guys.
No problem. It's always a pleasure to have you on. This is a fun book. It's a great book. So kind of give me an idea of what you did, see, saw, or just your experience to get prompted to do this book.
Well, you know, I was thinking about the absolute importance of barbecue, rubs, marinades, sauces. These are all the accessories, the flavorings that go into making good barbecue great and making great barbecue just over the top.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of misconceptions about rubs and marinades, when to apply them, when to use a wet rub, when to use a dry rub, when to use a marinade, when to put the barbecue sauce on. So that was sort of one of my motivations to writing the book. Another, you'll notice, is a very international book. Like always, when I start a new book, first thing I do is pack a suitcase. You can read about my travels throughout South Africa, Europe, Southeast Asia, India, Latin America, because it turns out that barbecue sauces, rubs, marinades, salsas, chutneys, etc., are one of the constants of the world's barbecue trail. Virtually everywhere, even in a country like Argentina, where it's, you know, barbecue is really pretty much just meat, salt, and fire, there are barbecue sauces.
Mm-hmm. Don't take away from the sauce topic just for a second. In general, don't you think we've kind of come full circle now? When you think about it, back in the 1700s, 1800s, and all the recorded time prior to that, we were cooking with open fires and stick wood, et cetera, et cetera. Then as technology came through and we've got electric ranges and stoves and gas ranges and stoves in our home and all this, and we kind of started out with the charcoal, very shallow barbecues back in the 50s, 60s, and then the Weber, you know, came out. The point is, to me, we've kind of come full circle on cooking, and now we're back cooking and seasoning for open flames.
Absolutely. And another thing that has happened is we started in this business actually more than a million years ago, grilling over wood. Today, wood has never been more important for the grilling experience in my lifetime. Using wood chips to generate smoke, using wood chunks to create smoke on a gas grill, actually burning logs in an Argentinian-style wood-fired grill.
Oh, I think it's great, and it is fun. So let's kind of start at the beginning for people. One of the things you talk about in the book is a Dalmatian rub, which is basically salt and pepper.
Correct.
And you've smoked some salts and different things like that. For the person that's just getting started into, and like Dr. Dave here, and getting into doing something a little more elaborate than just flipping burgers on the grill, what do you recommend for them? I mean, a Dalmatian rub is a great place to start, but where can they take it from there?
Well, you know, my basic all-purpose barbecue rub, I call it Reichland's rub or 4-4 rub, and it's equal parts salt, pepper, paprika, and brown sugar. And if you put those ingredients together, you will get a great-tasting barbecue rub. Now, where it gets interesting is how you can personalize that 4-4 mixture. So what can you do? First of all, instead of using sea salt or kosher salt, you could use a smoked salt. And instead of using black pepper, you could use white pepper. You could use red pepper. You could use a mixture of peppers. And instead of using paprika, sweet paprika, you could use hot paprika. You could use smoked paprika, what the Spanish call pimentón. And finally, in terms of sweeteners, instead of using brown sugar, you know, you could use maple sugar. You could use cane sugar. You could use freeze-dried cane juice. So already, just within the realm of four ingredients, you know, we've created maybe 15 or 16 different variations. Then to that basic mixture, you could add garlic powder, onion powder, celery seed, you know, which would give you a barbecue salt rub typical of the American South. You could add mustard powder in a nod to Georgia. You could add cumin and oregano and chili powder in a nod to the Southwest. So it's one principle is to understand sort of what the basic combinations, flavor combinations are, and then how to customize them.
I think most people, and I'm speaking from my own personal experience, that after you get to a certain level of cooking on the grill or barbecuing or smoking, and you want to, the flavor is fine, and you're trying kind of store-bought rubs or like this. I actually went out and started creating my own, and because I have a line of spices. But I did that because they just weren't exactly what I wanted. Now, not everybody likes every rub that's on the market, you know. But I think what you just suggested is they can go to a store. They can. We have a spice company here in Portland. We've got a couple of them. You can go to them once you get a little more advanced and do what you were saying, kind of create your own. And who knows? Maybe you have a world champion hit on your hands there. But I think it's, you know, particular and indicative to people's own personal tastes of what they look for in these things.
Yeah, absolutely. And then also, let's not forget, you know, the power of a rub to give ethnic identity to a food, a rub or a marinade. So I'm thinking of, you know, let's take your basic chicken breast, which is really a piece of pretty mild, even bland-tasting protein. Well, you could marinate it in an olive oil, lemon juice, herb, and garlic mixture in the style of the Mediterranean, maybe you would think you're in Italy or the south of France. You could marinate it in sesame oil, soy sauce, and mirin or maple syrup, and that takes you instantly to Southeast Asia. You could marinate it in a chimichurri mixture, in a pesto. In other words, the possibilities of customizing this basic protein by means of a rub are almost limitless.
Oh, yeah. And like we said, you know, depending on what, geographically where you were raised, how your mom cooked for you when you were a kid, I mean, it's really an endless, it's just up to your own imagination, I guess would be the best way to put it. As, you know, as long as you're trying not to rub dirt on it or something, I think you'd probably be fine.
Well, it's funny you should mention that. One of the new things I'm seeing more and more now are people are adding ground charcoal or ash to their rubs. You know, is it just for color? Yeah. Is there really much flavor in charcoal? Not that I can tell.
Yeah.
But, you know, we do eat with our eyes and as well as our palates. And the idea of a black barbecue rub, you know, it's sort of interesting. I mean, there are the black barbecue sauce from Owensboro, Kentucky, which, by the way, counterputs beautifully with the white barbecue sauce from Decatur, Alabama.
Sure.
So once you get into this, you know, one thing I love about barbecue and that has held my interest for 20 years is that it remains some of our last regional food in North America. Think about the homogenization of the American diet. But, you know, even in the realm of barbecue sauces, I mean, probably 2 dozen different styles of regional barbecue sauce in the U.S.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And Sweet Baby Ray's is the number one seller, at least retail-wise right now. We're going to take a break here on Barbecue Nation. We're going to be back with our friend Steve Reichlin talking about his new book, Barbecue Sauces, Rubs, and Marinades. And then there's some more base butters and glazes, too, right here on Barbecue Nation. Don't go away.
Try to amend my carnivorous habits. Made it nearly 7 or 8. Losing weight without speed eating sunflower seeds. Drinking lots of carrot juice and soaking up rays. But at night I'd have these wonderful dreams. Some kind of sensuous treat. Not zucchini, fettuccine.
Hey, welcome back to Barbecue Nation. JT here along with Dr. Dave. We've got Steve Reichlin on the phone. New book, Barbecue Sauces, Rubs, and Marinades, out in stores now. Great Father's Day gift, by the way. I think it would be good, especially if you take...
I could use one.
You could use one? Yeah. Well, I might give you one here.
Okay.
Okay. If you're serious about barbecuing, smoking, grilling, or cooking outside, or indoors for that matter, I think it's a must-have at this point. When people are trying to create a glaze, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, Stephen, but when they're trying to create a glaze, one of the problems people have is a lot of the stuff you buy off the shelf, it's brown. That's not the problem, but the sugar content is the problem because they don't pay attention when they're grilling. So if you were going to tell people to kind of start from scratch at home to make a very simple glaze, how would you explain that to them?
Well, let me back up if I may, because I think that to understand the whole use of rubs and sauces and marinades and glazes, you have to think of barbecue, you have to think of a three-step process,
mm-hmm.
right? And the first step are the flavorings that you put on the food before it goes on the grill. So basically that go on raw food. And that would be your rubs, it would be your marinades, it would be your seasoned salts, anything that goes on the food when it's still raw. The second phase is the one you were just talking about, and that is while the meat is cooking, what you put on the meat while it's cooking. And that is a very different kind of ingredients with a very different purpose than flavorings that go on with the food as raw. That might include butter, like a melted garlic parsley butter, garlic cilantro butter, an herb-flavored olive oil. It might include a mop sauce. It might include a glaze. Come back to glazes in a minute. The last phase is after the food comes off of your grill. It's already cooked, already smoked. What are you going to serve with it? And that might be a barbecue sauce, because for me, the sauce goes on at the very end. Might be ketchup. It might be mustard, both mm-hmm. of which we make homemade. Might be a salsa. It might be a relish. It might be a chutney. These are all flavorings that are applied to the food after it comes off the grill. Now, where it gets interesting is when you add a flavoring at each step along the way. So maybe you start with a rub or a marinade. Then while your food is cooking, you apply a butter, a baste, or a glaze. Then once it comes off, you serve it with a barbecue sauce or a chutney or a relish. Okay, so we call this layering of flavor in our field, layering of flavor. And it's one of the hallmarks of truly great barbecuing, and I would also add grilling. Now, to come back to your question about glazes are supposed to be a little sweet. One I like a lot is you get cherry syrup and you dissolve it with water. Maybe you put a little honey in it to bring up the sweetness. But the secret to a glaze is to add it very close to the end of cooking. Glazes mm-hmm. are sweet, and if you add them too quickly, the sugar in the glaze melts.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, you've been to people's homes. I've been to people's homes where, and especially I think when we were a lot younger, they started, I mean, as soon as they turned the rack of ribs or whatever they were cooking once, they started putting sauce on. And, you know, the nice bark or crust that we like to talk about sometimes wasn't so nice because it was all just black and the sugar wasn't even caramelized. It was, charcoalized there.
Charcoalized.
Is that a word?
You know, it's funny. You're saying that, you're reminding me of the quote-unquote barbecue I grew up with, which was chicken marinated in sweet barbecue sauce, grilled, direct grilled over a incomplete, imperfectly lit fire doused with kerosene or with lighter fluid. And the sauce would burn, the chicken would be raw in the center, the whole thing would be reeking of lighter fluid, and you'd order out for Chinese food. So
yep.
That was kind of, that was my barbecue experience. But barbecue sauce, yeah, I mean, the truly great guys serve their barbecue without sauce. You think of Aaron Franklin's brisket, I mean, or the Christ Market barbecue. They want you to experience the smoke and meat and spice flavors.
Absolutely.
They don't want you to camouflage everything with sauce. Now, in my world, I'm a little bit more broad-minded, and I can allow for a barbecue sauce, although I do not serve barbecue sauce with beef, but with pork and chicken, I do. But what you do with it is the last, so you've been indirect grilling or smoking your meat, the last 5 minutes of cooking, you move it directly over the fire, you hit it with your glaze, your barbecue sauce, you sizzle and you sizzle that sauce right into the meat, long enough to caramelize it, not so long that it burns. But that way, you get a crisp crust, you get your meat cooked perfectly, and then you get this sweet, salty, fiery, smoky glaze on top.
I wonder why my dad never thought of that. And this nasty, I mean, our chicken was served exactly the same way that you described yours. We had this shallow, I don't even know who made it, probably Ace Hardware or something, you know. That's what we had in our local town. Very shallow. The charcoal would probably only be 2 inches deep, maybe.
Yep.
Little well type, you know, sloped at the bottom, so maybe it was a little deeper there. Too close to the heat for what they were doing.
You had a little crank, right, that you could crank and raise and lower.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Bag. Oh yeah.
But of course that crank, that mechanism always bent after like the second time you used it. So you always had your grate kind of tipping perilously toward the coals.
Yep.
On one side.
Yep. And then we had a rotisserie attachment, but it didn't, yep, it didn't really turn. It would kind of go, and then it would hesitate, and then it would kind of go clunk, and then the chicken would be on the bottom, and then it would struggle to get the chicken back up to the top, and then it clunk to the bottom. So whatever part of the chicken hit when the clunk happened, that was the part that was the most crispy, and the other part was raw. So,
you know, you're actually making a very good point, which is when I like to think of barbecue, it involves all five senses. So obviously we think of sight, we think of smell, we think of taste. You know, it's a very tactile experience too, poking a steak to check for its doneness. But you have added the sense of sound, of hearing, the audios of barbecue, the clunk. You know when something is going wrong. You can hear when something is going wrong.
Yep. Yep.
Important thing for people to remember.
You can. We're going to take another break and talk about clunks when we come back with Stephen Reichlin, talking about his new book, Barbecue Sauces, Rubs, and Marinades, here on Barbecue Nation. Don't go away.
Let go!
Hey, welcome back to Barbecue Nation. Really quickly, if you'd like to email us, it's BBQNation, the letters BBQNation at KXL.com, or recipes at KXL.com. Check us out on Facebook. It's BBQNation/JT. You can find us there. And to our affiliates, I'd like to say hi to KWRO in Coos Bay and the one you're listening to right now here in Portland, KXTG 102.9 and 750 The Game. And that's all on the Radio Northwest Network. Let's get back to our friend Stephen Reichlin here talking about stuff. One thing I noticed when I was reviewing the book, Stephen, and one of the reasons I like your book, I'll step up back a second, is because you always have some historical knowledge in your book, in your research and doing this. Okay. And so when you look at the changes in food and like ketchup, you know, of course, we're familiar with Heinz ketchup, and you make note of that in your in your book and stuff, but when you're going back to the 1700s, 1800s, maybe as far back as the 15, 1600s, how we do things, and again, that comes back to that full circle, you know, with the chutney you talk about, sambals, those types of things, relishes. I think we've come a long ways, but we also learned from our past.
Well, we do, and what's extraordinary to me, you know, we began cooking, humankind began cooking about 1.8 million years ago. And it was probably the most important discovery, invention in human history. Because once our distant prehistoric ancestors started cooking meat over fire, everything changed. Our brains quadrupled in size. Our jaws diminished in size. Our tongues became more agile so we could speak. We developed this communal social organization where not only do we share a meal, do we gather together around a fire to cook a meal, but we even have a division of labor where one part of the community stays back and tends the fires, both literally and metaphorically. The other goes out in the workplace to bring home the bacon. Again, both literally and metaphorically. So really, everything that makes us human began with this first act of cooking over live fire.
And those were some big pterodactyls or whatever they were, they were cooking.
You know, pterodactyl is the wrong epic, but certainly mastodons, woolly mammoths. I mean, we learn not only to bring down, but to butcher and cook.
Mm-hmm.
unimaginably large animals.
Well, they, you know, we're not really sure in the, not to get off in history here, but the tribes that, you know, the groups of people are distant relatives, we're not sure how big they are all the time, so they might have been feeding a whole group of people off a mastodon or something, you know. You never know.
I'm sure it was huge. But you know, what's interesting to me, and unfortunately the historical record is a little bit more vague, is when we went from, you know, hunters and gatherers, it's well documented, kill animals, cut them up, cook them over fire. But there's no seasoning, not even salt. It's very opportunistic, and I would call it's not cuisine. You don't get cuisine until you start to flavor meat. Now, we know they found mustard seeds at prehistoric sites. They found salt, obviously. I mean, many cities in Europe, like Salzburg, Hallsberg, mm-hmm. were named for salt deposits. So those are probably two of the early seasonings. You know, we know that garlic grew wild. We know that onions grew wild. But it'd be really interesting to know when we started seasoning our food and turning it, you know, from sustenance into barbecue.
And not to make light of anything, but I've always wanted to know, and this is true, I've thought about this 1,000 times. Who was the first guy to eat, like, the berries that weren't poisonous and the berries that were? Who volunteered for that job so they could determine
really
who was what was what, you know? Don't eat those, Dave.
I think it was trial and error, wasn't it?
Probably.
Yeah, but I think it was trial and error because, you know, don't forget, ancient man was much more observant and attuned to his surroundings than we are. And, you know, I would imagine that early man probably observed which berries got eaten by birds and which berries were left alone by bears, by other animals. So that's already a first wave piece of information.
Oh, sure. But I'm sure that, you know, some class clown like me would be going, okay, Dave, you know, I'll give you this mastodon bone I found the other day if you go over there and try those berries. Anyway, we'll do that. What would you like people to really get out of this book, Stephen? I mean, there's so much, like all your books, there's so much information in there. There's just tons of it. And it's not something that, I mean, from somebody who reads a lot of cookbooks and stuff, it's not something you can just kind of browse over. If you're really going to get into this, you got to really dig into the, not just this book, but all your books. But what would you like?
Thank you. Well, I think there are two things I'd like people to come away with. And number one is this concept of the layering of flavors, you know, using certain seasonings when the meat is raw, certain seasonings when the meat is on the grill, and certain seasonings once the meat is cooked. That's a really important principle, and that will help anybody up their game. The second thing I'd like people to come away with is how universal the notion of rubs, marinades, barbecue sauces, pastes, and butters are. In my book, you will find barbecue sauces from around the world. You'll find marinades from all over the world. You will find rubs from all over the world. And it's to me, it's very comforting to know that, you know, human beings all over the world sort of face the same challenge, which is how do we cook meat over live fire?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we make it taste better and more flavorful? And my book, in a way, is that it pays homage to the ingenuity of grill masters all over the world for their amazing sauces. You know, there are also some kind of cute stories, too. What's the weirdest sauce in the book? Well, maybe it's a monkey gland sauce from South Africa. And I have to hasten to add that no primates suffered in its preparation.
Yeah,
but basically, if you take chutney and you boil it with red wine, that sort of sweet, spicy, and then the acidity from the wine, that's what monkey gland sauce is. But it was pioneered by a chef who wanted to grab people's attentions, make them sit up and take notice, and it sure did. And, you know, I mean, there are dozens of sauces that have stories like that.
What's your favorite, like, chutney? I mean, if I said, Stephen Reichlin, you're coming to my house for dinner and I want to fix you something special, but you clue me in on what you really like.
Well, I like a mango chutney in the sweet arena, and I like a tomato chutney, which is a little bit different than most people think of chutneys. It's not really sweet. It's more tomato, spicy, herbal. But I love a tomato chutney.
And, you know, that was just talking about my childhood there. And it's funny to me but interesting how we were talking earlier in one of the segments about coming full circle and how mm-hmm. the things that were done a couple hundred years ago and then most likely in Europe and those places and overseas, and then they come to America and then we've modified them ourselves to what my mom and grandma made or what your mom and grandma made, what have you. I find that completely fascinating because what's the old saying? The apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. We tinker and we mess around with this stuff, but really the basics have been around for a long time.
They have been. But, you know, there are also some new techniques, too. And one that came to my attention, it's called Monroe County Grilled Pork Steaks. Now, Monroe County is in Kentucky. Kentucky is a great hotbed of barbecue diversity and excellence. But a couple things that are unusual about this preparation. So number one, pork shoulder steak. Usually we think of pork shoulder as being smoked whole. But here somebody cuts it into steaks on a butcher saw. Second of all, we think of this part of the world, this part of America, as being barbecued, that is cooked low and slow with a lot of wood smoke. And these pork steaks are actually direct grilled. But the final thing, and this is, you know, this is a preparation that I'm seeing it everywhere now since the book came out. But, you know, I don't think people and anybody outside of Monroe County knew about it before a year ago. It's a fiery dip made of vinegar, melted butter, and hot sauce.
Oh.
Super hot.
There you go.
So what you do, and this is one of those flavorings that use while the meat is cooking.
Hey Stephen. Stephen, yeah. Hold on a second. We're up against a hard break. Keep that thought. We'll finish that when we come back, okay? All right. We're gonna go away for just a minute on Barbecue Nation. We're gonna be back. Stephen's gonna tell you how to finish that sauce.
The sun is hot and that old clock is moving slow.
Welcome back to Barbecue Nation. I'm JT, along with Dr. Dave, and Stephen Reichlin's on the phone in Colorado with us today, out there doing his thing on the book tour. And the book is Barbecue Sauces, Rubs, and Marinades. Great book. I recommend it. Now let's finish that story about the sauces, Kentucky.
So this is a dipping sauce, and you use it while the meat is cooking and then once it's completely cooked. And the essence of the sauce is better for richness, it's bigger for acidity. It's as much hot sauce and cayenne pepper as you can bear to add. So it's really, it's rich and fiery. Once those pork shoulder steaks are cooked halfway through, you dip them in the sauce, then you put them back on the grill. So at that point, your sauce is acting like a glaze, the ingredients thicken, and sear right into the meat. Then when your pork is done, comes off again, it goes in that dip one more time, and then it's served. And actually, if you're a real glutton for punishment, you can dip it twice. But, you know, we're talking about some serious fire. And by the way, even as I mentioned that, I'm thinking of a Japanese teriyaki marinade called tare. And it's, you know, the usual effects. It's soy sauce for saltiness. There's sugar and for sweetness. There's sesame oil for richness. And with that, you grill a little yakitori, a little chicken kebab. Mm-hmm. Gets dipped in this mixture halfway through, back on the grill to cook the glaze into the meat, then in the mixture a second time as a sauce. So, you know, there are analogs in this great planet barbecue. There are analogs on all corners of the globe with these preparations.
Okay, one last question for you, Stephen, before we got to get out of here. What did you take from, proper grammar, which I'm not known for on the last segment of the show, but what did you get out of writing this book? I mean, you discover things all the time, but what did you get out of this, the one main thing?
Well, I guess for me, it was sort of, you know, so much of barbecue is superstition and random information and practices done because your father did it or your neighbor did it or your community did it. And what writing this book did is it really enabled me to kind of figure out the system, understand the grammar of barbecue sauces, rubs, and marinades, how they go in together. And again, it's, you know, that model of what goes on when the meat is raw, what goes on while it's cooking, what goes on after it's done. That was just so helpful for me to figure out. Also, sort of understanding, well, how the flavorings change when you're in North America, or you go to South America, or you go to Europe or Southeast Asia. For me, it was a way to sort of bring order to chaos. Very good tasting chaos, but chaos nonetheless.
If you could only go by Washington, D.C. and do that for us, then we'd all just have it made.
Oh, man, wouldn't that be great? Hey, by the way, I just wanted to mention a couple things. First of all, my website is barbecuebible.com. That's barbecuebible.com. I have a free newsletter you can sign up for that comes out every other week. We've got a free recipe of the week, and it's a great resource. The second thing I wanted to mention is that the latest season of my Project Smoke TV show just started airing. So I know you'll be able to watch it on Oregon Public Television, but this year we did a lot more grilling. We brought in a lot more extreme smoking techniques. You will see salt slabs. You will see blow torches. You will see smoking and grilling like you never imagined possible.
That's my kind of cooking, blow torches.
Blow torches, I like. And not for creme brulee either.
No.
And not for creme brulee, no sir.
Nice.
Are you coming up in this area this year?
You know, I'll be in Seattle in about 10 days. I'm actually not coming to Portland this year, but I have a new book in the works that'll be out next spring, and I know I'll be back to Portland for that.
Well, we'll have to have you in studio again.
I would like that.
When you do that, that's good. How's our time there, David? We just got to go? Okay. Stephen Reichland, we appreciate you being with us. By the way, the book is out there now. Again, Barbecue Sauces, Rubs, and Marinades. I'm supposing you can get it not only on Stephen's website, but in all your Barnes and Nobles and Powell's.
Bookstores anywhere, Powell's Books, local bookstores, Amazon.com, wherever books are sold, you will find barbecue sauces, rubs, and marinades.
And probably in a lot of the barbecue stores around here. I imagine they've got some of those too. So,
absolutely.
It's very good. And don't forget, who we got? Oh, Jamie Provance is going to be in next week.
Nice.
To talk to us too. So,
say hi to Jamie for me.
I will
One
do
of my
that.
Favorite guys.
I'll do that. He's a good guy. I like him a lot.
Good guy.
And this, so we got to get out of here. I just want to remind you one thing. When somebody asks you how long a minute is, it just depends on what side of the bathroom door you're standing on. So for Dr. Dave and Stephen Reichland, I'm JT. Have a good week, everybody. Grill something. Bye-bye.
It took her 3